Having a fantastic day. Wow, it is Saturday, September 16th. Can you believe it's September? I'm in North Carolina, and this morning, actually, the temperature in the house was below what it was set, like the air conditioning was set overnight. It's crazy. Cold. I like it. I'm tired. Wow, the lights just blinked. It's the Orthodox coming to stream cuts, and I disappear forever. You know who made me. I'm joking, guys. I'm joking. Okay. So yeah, it's nice and chill now. It's got that like first fall chill to it. I mean, it's going to be brutally hot here for another month, but it's exciting. Almost fall time. So I see the comments are popping up left and right. So I will eventually get to those, but first, make sure you become a patron if you're not a patron. Yeah, do that. Okay. Now that we got that over, and I'll put one of those cool banners. What in the world is going on here? That's kind of concerning. What is going on? Okay. Maybe I shouldn't be asking people to become patrons. That's kind of. So if the stream cuts and I disappear, or I all of a sudden become a SCOTUS or something like that, you know. You guys know what happened. You guys know what happened. Okay. So comment section. Actually, before I want to get to the comment section, there's a Sebastian, I love your question. I will answer it in a minute because I've been talking about it with friends over the last few days in particular. Still using your laptop webcam? It's not my laptop webcam. Look, I'm touching it. No, it's up there. My laptop webcam is just down there. See? Down there. Okay, I do need the shape, though. Anyone in Virginia? No, I'm not in Virginia. But what did I want to talk about? There's something I've been discussing this. Oh, yes. So I've been discussing this with... What is going on there? Okay, this is getting kind of creepy. I want to turn the light off, but then my lighting would be horrible. Yeah, that's very concerning. Maybe it's because I was late, Anthony. Maybe you're right. Maybe I am being debunked because I'm late. But okay, I will finally get to actually what I'm talking about. And yes, it's just me today, so everybody can leave. We can get down to like two people, the two true Thomists, watching what's going on. But I was discussing Baptism of Desire with a priest and its relation to limbo, because if you guys don't know, Cajetan in the 16th century, in his Summa Commentaries, specifically his commentary on Tertia Pars, he put forward a novel opinion on Baptism of Desire for infants who die without baptism. If they have Christian parents, the desire of the parents is going to somehow be applicable for the baptismal graces for the child. Now, this doesn't work because the reason Baptism of Desire even works is because it has the desire for the sacraments and the perfect act of love and contrition, act of love and perfect contrition. Those provide the same effects as baptism. So that's why it's Baptism of Desire. So it doesn't make sense to, you know, count it for somebody else. So there's that aspect to it for why it's wrong. And the theological schools, actually the Council of Trent was considering condemning Cajetan's opinion, but decided that it was imprudent. So Pius V just took it out of his works, expunged it from his works, the opinion. But the schools have universally just rejected Cajetan's opinion. But what's really, really, really weird was the fact that you'll have people out there who are affirming Cajetan's opinion on the one hand, then on the other hand, denying limbo. What's the problem here? I actually put it to my wife this morning to see if she would be able to catch the problem. And so I'll see if you guys can catch the problem. So you believe Christian parents, due to the desire they have for the baptism of their children, that the children receive a baptism of desire. So they receive sanctifying grace, which is proportioned to the beatific vision. Therefore, when they die, they will therefore enter into the beatific vision. And you also deny limbo on the other hand. What's the problem there? Can anybody catch it? The problem here is that what you have when you take Cajetan's opinion and then take a denial of limbo, because Cayetanus did not deny limbo. He affirmed limbo. Who did he affirm it for? We can take his reasoning. The limbo of infants, he affirmed it for the children of non-Christian parents. So you combine Cajetan's belief on baptism of desire with a modern belief of the denial of limbo, which according to the ITC document, you can't hold. According to the Magisterium of the Church, you can't hold. Even the ITC document does not affirm a denial of limbo. It just affirmed the possibility that nobody may be there. But take these two positions. What do you have for the children of non-Christian parents? To go to hell. That's very problematic. So yeah, I put it to Hassan this morning. I'm like, well, the modern theologians are like, hey, we have this position from Cajetan that's very useful. We don't want to affirm limbo. So we found you guys a solution for the children of Christian parents and how they can go to heaven. But, you know, we got some bad news about the children of non-baptized parents, non-Christian parents. This is the position. And it's pretty horrific, actually. So really what they're going to have to say in the end is, because obviously they're not going to want to hold that consequence, they're going to have to say, well, God just gives extraordinary grace to the children of non-baptized parents, I mean, non-Christian parents. God's going to give extraordinary grace to them. Well, it's like on this hand, one, you're going against the ITC document, because the ITC document says that we can't hold that we have any sort of probability or at least any sort of certainty. We can't be certain about the fact that God will give this grace. So you're going against the ITC document. And on the other hand, why are you even quoting Cayetanus at this point, except to put over this veil of probability that you're somehow in continuity with an older tradition? It really makes absolutely no sense to me. So that's my rant for the morning. That one's for free. If any of you guys have questions about limbo and such, I'd be happy to answer them. Okay, so, oh man, where is Hassan? He's not, he said he was busy. It's cringe. Nah, I think he's like on a trip or something like that. How the filioque leads to being late for a stream. So true. Okay, I'm just starring some. Oh, will I continue my post-conciliar series on the authority of St. Thomas? Well, actually, this is still kind of under the wraps. We're actually being kind of brought in, I guess you could say, to write an essay for a book that's coming out on Vatican II, and they want me to write it on the authority of St. Thomas in Vatican II. So I've been working on that. So I've kind of had to put a pause on the whole series, unfortunately. But you guys will get an essay out of this. So I hope that's I hope that's at least equivalent. Okay. So, Sebastian, what is some practical advice for married laymen trying to live out the evangelical counsels, like poverty? Are there any treatises on this, like a manual? So, unfortunately, I've literally looked everywhere I possibly could about this. I've been doing a lot of research. I put together a bit of a notes document, I guess you could say. I don't really feel comfortable, I guess you could say, writing anything official on this, because there's just not that much out there. So it would be a little bit of speculation on my part. But I'll tell you at least the broad lines of what I've been able to see in the spiritual writings when they write about the evangelical councils. So you have the spiritual organism. We all know about that. Sanctifying grace, the formal and physical, yet analogous and accidental participation in the divine nature and the nature of the soul, which is an entitative habit. That is, it alters the mode of being rather than merely the mode of acting, which would be an operative habit. So that's the first place. That's a bunch of jargon. You don't need to know about that. Basically, our soul participates in God. That's all you need to know. And this flows over into all of the faculties of our soul. So into our intellect, towards God as faith, towards our will, towards God as charity, and then also towards created things, in the infused moral virtues, blah, 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 blah. You guys don't really, you know, some of you care about this. Some of you are just, you know, I'm like the teacher in Charlie Brown. And just, you guys aren't hearing what I'm saying right now. But all of that aside, spiritual organism, what we have with the fall is just as there was a triple integrity of the soul in the state of original justice, now there's a triple disintegrity, if you want to put it like that. So the triple integrity is the right rectitude of the higher faculties, so the intellect and will towards God, and then the right rectitude of the lower faculties towards the intellect, and then of the soul in general towards the body. So that's the triple integrity. So there's a right ordering in the gift of original justice to Adam. But we lose this in the fall. So what the evangelical councils do is they actually reverse this disorder through the increasing fervency of the perfection of charity, which the evangelical councils secondarily and instrumentally bring about. And they bring it about through the submission of the higher faculties to God in obedience, through the lower faculties to the higher faculties in chastity, and through the body to the lower faculties in poverty. So poverty, chastity, and obedience place us in right ordering to the entire world. Now, what you do not misunderstand me, because this doesn't mean that everybody is in the quote state of perfection, which refers to the monastic life. So not everybody takes vows of the effective practice of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Rather, with an A, the affective practice is demanded of all, or the spirit of the councils is demanded of all. And as Garrigou says, the spirit of the councils, all that means is the effective practice of the councils in accordance with one's state in life. So I'll give you an example. If you are a father of a family, obviously you can't live the life of a Franciscan with poverty. You need some sort of money as means of taking care of your family. So there's a degree in which you cannot effectively practice the councils because you have to own stuff. But there's a degree in which you do effectively practice the councils. For example, if you're relatively simple with the, I don't know, type of clothes you buy, you're not too attached, or like the type of car you buy or something like that. You're not too attached to these certain luxuries. You're living the spirit of poverty by effectively practicing it to the degree in which you can. So the same goes for chastity. To increase in the spirit of the council of chastity, you're effectively practicing it as much as you can. So obviously, as it's a remedy of concupiscence. It's something which is for the procreation of children, which both includes the actual production of a new life and the union of spouses in order to effectively raise up children. So obviously, you're going to need to engage in the marital use, at least for a time. But the striving towards perfection is the striving towards something like a spiritual marriage eventually. And not all are able to reach that level, obviously. So that's what the spirit of the councils means. And according to the degrees of charity is in accordance with one's practice of the councils. So in the illuminative way, we have what's called the second degree of charity. And the second degree of charity requires the effective practice of the councils. And then the third degree of perfection requires what's called the heroic practice of the councils. But all this to say is basically all you need to know kind of for the living out of the evangelical councils for married laymen is to practice them as much as you're able to and to strive for more. That's basically it. So something like poverty, there's obviously going to be a cap. Like, you're not going to be able to raise kids while living homeless or something like that. It's obviously ridiculous. But something like obedience, you can continue to grow in the council of obedience almost without limit. And something like chastity, obviously in union with one's spouse, you shouldn't deprive of the marital use for its lawful uses. But that obviously can, in many circumstances, reach the level of something like a spiritual marriage, and that's the sort of ideal in which people are shooting for if they're able to. So yeah, I think that is about all. But it is very concerning that it seems like the magisterium is actually quite clear about this. Talking about the priest as the example of the evangelical councils for the layman, the fact that the evangelical councils, or at least the spirit of the evangelical councils, is something which is universal. There's a clarity about this from the teaching all from the magisterium of the church. There's clarity about it for sure. But unfortunately, it's just not something that's really talked about. So yeah, when you do get the passing comments on the evangelical councils and its practice in laymen, it's kind of like, yeah, it's super, super, super hard to practice this as a layman. It's super duper duper hard. And you know, there's a few people who did it, but it's super, super hard. And it's like, okay, we kind of get it that it's hard to remain detached from these goods while in the world, but you know, at least give me some practical advice about it. But usually they'll just point to a set of saints who have done it and then just say it's really super hard and then kind of move on from there. So it is annoying that there isn't as much, you know, practical advice on it, but that's what I've gotten, and I'm not really comfortable, I guess, explaining any more than that. Okay, so are you considering inviting Father Pine to your Saturday morning show? I've thought about it. That would be cool, though. Okay, let me... can you discuss St. Bonaventure versus St. Thomas on the Father's hypostatic property, unbegotten versus begetting? Whether the Father has quasi-personhood prior to generation? No. So the Father, so there's, for those who don't know, there's two notes that are given to the Father. Well, technically three if you want to include active spiration. So these two are inascibility, which is basically unbegottenness. And then there's paternity, which is the fact that he is begetting the Son. So from the very name of Father, I think it becomes clear that the formal constituent of the Father's hypostasis is the fact that he begets the Son, not his inascibility. So yeah, I guess that's just like my really brief comment is he's not called the Inashable. He's called the Father. But I haven't really dove into it much more than this. Okay, you're really curious on your take on Sapius Officio and then Apostolicae Curiae. I haven't thought about that in forever. So yeah, sorry, I don't have much thoughts on it. Okay, so can you speak on your thoughts on Astro versus Jay Dyer stream and your Filioque debate coming up, please? I don't really have much to say about the Astro versus Jay Dyer stream. You just watch it yourself and, you know, come up with what you think. I do think there was some misunderstanding on the part of Jay, not necessarily saying that he like misunderstood Thomism or anything, but I think Astro was showing that the Thomistic position is not mutually, you know, interiorly contradictory. And that was Astro's goal. But Jay wanted Astro to demonstrate the Thomistic position, which are two different things. One's positive, the other's negative. One's offensive, one's defensive. So I think that was like, it was a bit annoying to listen to because it seems like Astro was like, hey, this isn't interiorly contradictory. And then Jay's like, well, could you prove this, and this position? And Astro's like, well, I just proved it. And then by prove it, he means just showed that it wasn't something which was contradictory. So yeah, I think that's basically how the whole debate went. So my Filioque debate coming up, it just is what it is. So we'll see. Will we save up the decent questions for when Hassan is gone? When he's back, we go back to the tarded questions. Okay, so thoughts on the Augustinian school holding that infants in limbo suffer from punishment of sense? Good question. So it's not entirely clear, and it seems like this is the way Thomas is reading Augustine. It's not entirely clear that that St. Augustine himself held to the punishment of sense. And actually some of the 19th and early 20th century theologians also held the same as St. Thomas. So maybe they were misreading Augustine on this point. But it seems like St. Robert Bellarmine and Cardinal Franzlin, both who are Jesuits, they're not strictly speaking part of the Augustinian school, but it seems like both of them did hold to some sort of punishment of sense for infants. But I actually think that's quite bad, to be perfectly frank. I think the punishment of sense for unbaptized infants is quite bad because it seems like that's the punishment for actual sin. That's the argument of St. Thomas, is that they can't have the beatific vision because they don't have sanctifying grace. They can't have the punishment of sense because they didn't commit any actual sin. Therefore, they're going to have natural beatitude without the beatific vision. That's basically it. Oh, am I going to have to debunk Hassan right now? Okay, so he said, bruh, evangelical poverty does not mean being impoverished. It means detachment. So yeah, detachment from those certain goods almost necessarily, at least morally speaking, it necessitates the effective practice of the spirit of the council. So this is at least what Father Garrigou says. Is he says, I cannot see how one could practice the spirit of the council without the effective practice of the council. So, too bad, Hassan. Too bad, Hassan. Okay, so what do you think of St. Gregory Nazianzus saying that the Holy Spirit is between the Father and the Son, or is this an implicit affirmation of the Holy Spirit being the nexus of love of the Father and the Son? I got this. I got some stuff. I'm not going to be answering many questions on the filioque. Sorry. I just, you know, don't want to. You can buy your Ferrari, but do not be attached to it. Sayyid Hassan Ahmed. Okay, you probably don't need 3 resort vacations a year, nor do you need to eat premium food all the time. You can live out poverty literally by fasting, wearing uncomfy clothes, etc. Don't smoke. Sorry about that, bro. I think you're wrong about that one. And have no unnecessary additional occasions of intemperance. Okay. Yeah, I literally forget the AE ending all the time because I'm dumb. The best way to save money on clothes is to convince the women in your family to dress for not drawing attention rather than the opposite. Dude, I'm sorry, man. Ava's clothes are very cute, and you can cry about it. Her clothes are the cutest clothes ever. So, and all of the bows meant to draw attention to her cute noggin. So you can cry about it, Hassan. Oh yeah, there was a good question above, Hassan. Maybe I thought that you might be able to answer this, in the comments. So, do I have to read to debate Muslims on TikTok? I would love to hear Hassan's response to this. So, please do. Okay, so is there any conditional God when choosing who will receive efficacious grace? When Aquinas says someone can put an obstacle to grace, does that mean one is one of the conditions of receptiveness? Okay, so there's a principle called the principle of predilection, which is basically that the what hast thou that thou hast not received? It's basically the theological formulation of that, which is essentially that God does not love one more than another because that thing is better than another thing. Rather, something is better than another thing because God loves that thing more than another. Because our wills are passively drawn out to certain goods, where God's will isn't passively drawn out. God's will is active and communicates goodness. So when it comes to efficacious grace, the condition is merely the fact that God loves something, someone, I guess you could say, more than another. Because election follows upon love and predestination follows upon election. I think he says this explicitly in De Veritate, if I'm remembering correctly. So receptiveness is not a condition on the part of God. It's a condition on the part of the one chosen. And St. Thomas talks about this in, I think, Article 3 of Question 23 of Prima Pars, maybe Article 4, which he basically says that when we talk about conditions on the part of God, we're talking about whether God will do something or not. That's basically it. And obviously, God does not consider conditions before acting because God, the conditions themselves come from the will of God. So what we're saying is that on the part of things, there's some sort of ordering and relationship of contingency that God has established. So he establishes he establishes the, let's say, receptiveness on the part of somebody as a means of bringing about certain ends. So God does not establish this on account of that. Rather, that follows from this because God has established it thus. If that makes any more sense to you. Sorry if I was unclear. If someone blocked the Pope Twitter account, would they have to go to confession? It's okay, Hassan. I don't drink, so yeah. You could you are so sneaky, Hassan. You drink, I smoke. I don't drink, you don't smoke. So we can each, you know, complimentary on this. Oh no, North Carolina. Pack of cigs is like $6 or $7. Yeah, Father Lagrange did say that he actually didn't smoke throughout his whole life. What are Wagner's credentials? I have none. Problem? Question mark. Explain denial of gnomic will, the temptation of Christ in light of Hebrews 4:15. Was he tempted in the same way or in a similar way? I'm not sure what you mean by gnomic will, actually. So if you could explain that, that'd be great. But basically, when it's talking about the temptation of Christ in Hebrews 4:15, St. Thomas distinguishes between the temptation towards evil and the temptation, I guess you could say, away from the practice of something that they should do. So it's like a positive temptation and a negative temptation, basically. Temptation of putting an evil object before someone versus the temptation of placing difficult circumstances to receive a certain good, to persevere towards that good. So when it comes to Christ's tempting, it wasn't the fact that Christ had some sort of evil object put before him that he was considering doing and whatever like that. Rather, if you look at the whole purpose of the book of Hebrews, and especially of the section that you're talking about, the entire book of Hebrews is about this as a sort of secondary to the Christ fulfillment of old law, has to do with Christ, our example in the pursuit of the good. So Christ, his temptation was really the extraordinarily difficult circumstances that he was put in and the persevering towards good that he did through that. So it's kind of like an example of us in the spiritual life progressing through certain purifications, which happen through the difficulties that we're in. It's kind of like when you look in the book of Job. This is always the example I give people as like a biblical example. You have in the beginning, Job has a bunch of stuff good. God permits Satan to tempt Job. Job has like 30 chapters of desolation. And then through this desolation, Job is able to become detached from those goods that he had and that he had lost. And then God rewards him in the end with even more goods. So obviously righteous Job was in certain ways imperfect, and he was purged from these imperfections through his sufferings. But Christ is himself not being purged from imperfections, but himself a model of this purification that comes through trial. So that's what like the temptation of Christ means. Unfortunately, there are no commentaries on De Potentia. Yes, I've read a book or two. Oh, I mean, does he have a degree in philosophy or something like that? Yes, I'm finishing up my master's in theology, And then I will be moving to Rome for future study after that. So if man cannot accept grace before first being moved, how would this avoid compulsion? So one, there's actually two ways in which we can answer this. So I will, usually the question people are asking is about like the relationship between the movement of the divine will and then the movement of our wills in our order. So I'll just answer that general question. If you have a further question about how this fits in with grace, I can also answer that. But usually the first question suffices for most people. So according to St. Thomas, he basically formulates it like this. God causes it. We cause it. There's no contradiction to that being free. He really doesn't concern himself with a lengthy apology for how these two fit in. But basically, the way in which the Thomists are going to generally, and I'm just going to be going over like the basics that everybody agrees upon within the Thomistic school. Basically, they say that the will of God, the causality of God moving, and the causality of our will, freely willing, they're said to be subordinated. So you have, in essence, God is big enough to cause something after the manner of a free effect. So we cannot bring about necessarily, as in the necessity of the consequence, not the necessity of the consequent, which you know you don't need to know right now. But God can... We have to, you know, force somebody to bring about a certain end necessarily. God, on the other hand, can bring about a certain end necessarily and have the means to that end as secondary causes happen in a contingent manner. So God is big enough to cause things after the manner of a free act, where we just aren't. So that's what's sort of clear in the mystery. But the intimate reconciliation is something that's beyond the powers of any man. So I hope that's sufficient. It usually isn't sufficient for people because then they're like, well, I kind of don't grasp this. And you know. But I hope that helped at least. There's a good quote. I posted it earlier from, was it from Billy Wart? Let me see. Bam, 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 bam. He had a really good quote on this. Oh no, this is going to annoy me if I can't. Oh yeah. He says, nothing is more absurd than to say that our choice cannot be free because God efficaciously wills it to be free. That's in essence. And it's Bossuet said it. Yeah, there you go. Whoa. If smoking bad, why does it make me look cool? That's a good point, Nassan. Oh my. That's so. He preferred clerics smoking than taking sniffing tobacco. Snuff, so that consuming tobacco inside the sanctuary would stop. Yeah, believe it or not, that he. I like how James, you're tagging Hassan and said, believe it or not, some of my most drinkiest and drunkiest friends have been Muslim. And Hassan's like, yeah, I know. That's a huge problem. That's just a huge problem. Okay. I'm looking through to find some good stuff. Okay, so I guess I'll address this. I don't know why I just feel a bit uncomfortable, you know, answering spiritual questions. So I just like to recommend books. See, that's the easy way out of it. Rather than me telling you what I've gotten from the books. I'll just give you the books themselves and you can just read them. There you go. So no middleman. So there's really two aspects to the spiritual life that everything, you know, is summarized by. And the first is prayer. And do I not have my catechism? No, I don't. So Simler's, and I will put a link in. Simler's Catechism of Mental Prayer. This will give you sort of the basics of. I'm just telling you the means. So focus on these two things because as you read Simler's Catechism of Mental Prayer, you will recognize that mental prayer is specifically ordered towards positively towards the destruction of certain vices that you can focus your meditations on. So that's the first aspect is prayer. And the second aspect is that's like directed towards God. Now directed towards ourself, that second aspect is called mortification. So mortification isn't like, you know, whipping yourself on the back or wearing hair shirts or, you know, staying up all night in prayer or taking cold showers. Can be, but that's not the essence of mortification. The essence of mortification is basically the contradiction of will. That's what's called contradiction of will. So this is basically what's broadly referred to as ascetical theology. And ascetical theology, it's meant to detach you from both inordinate attachments and then also inordinate attachments that could be sinful and then inordinate attachments that are imperfections. I guess that's how I'll distinguish it so you guys understand it better. And the best one on this is Scopoli's Spiritual Combat. This is really just a nice introduction to what ascetical theology is supposed to look like and the proper relationship of like the exterior mortification stuff. But yeah, just those two books will give you all, more than enough for what you need to know just for your prayer and mortification, which are just the foundational elements of your spiritual life. Those are the two things you need to focus on and just focus on doing them very well. It's very, very important. So yeah, you can get those two off of Tan Books for like $15. And shipping probably can get it less than $20 total. But yeah, just focus on the generals before you focus on the particulars. It's very important. Oh, Hassan's a convert to Catholicism. Does the Orthodox have a concept of dogmatic faith, believing the articles and account of God revealing them? No. I don't know. Is the concept of dogmatic faith falsifiable? I don't know what you mean by that. Are the first principles of reason falsifiable? Like do you mean that could they be wrong? No. Okay, so I think you need to read about the distinction between actual and sanctifying grace. So I think the Catechism of Pius X has a good section talking about the distinction. So if you just look up the Catechism of Pius X, look up actual grace, this should help you. Okay, so what is your opinion on Calvinism as a Thomist? Okay. Whew. This is good. I know like both sides aren't going to be happy with this. That's why I like sigh like this before I answer this question. Because the Catholics are not going to want me to say that Calvinism is actually not as bad as they think it is. And the Calvinists are going to be mad because I'm going to tell them that they're misreading St. Thomas on a very important point. So here it goes. So Calvinism commonly taken among, like, you know, your normal average layman is just like predestination. Now, the Catholic Church teaches predestination. It's just a question of how one articulates it. Now, the Thomists believe in predestination ante praevisa merita. That means before the consideration of merits. This at this point, we agree with the Calvinists. We both believe that predestination is before the consideration of any merit. We also agree on reprobation. So reprobation for both the Thomists and the general opinion of the Reformed theologians is something which is the will of God the consequent will of God not to give grace to somebody, not to give sanctifying grace to somebody. So it's something which is a privation. It's not that God is somehow actively infusing evil into somebody's soul or forcing their hand to hell. God chooses not to give grace, consequently, and I'll explain that in a second. He chooses not to give grace, and that person falls into sin. And then, as St. Thomas says, on account of that sin, he judges them worthy of hell. So reprobation actually doesn't really have to do with the ordering towards hell. It has to do with the privation of grace. And then what's called praedamnatio, or a pre-damnation, is the decree to damn on account of sin. So that's after. So the praedamnatio is after the consideration of merits, demerits. Reprobation is before the consideration of demerits. And this is explicitly what St. Thomas says, is that reprobation is also ante praevisa merita. So at this point, Calvinists, Thomists, we have substantial agreement. There's not really any disagreement on predestination, reprobation. Now, to the disagreement. So we distinguish, as Thomists, between the what's called the antecedent will of God and the consequent will of God. So the antecedent will of God is God's will towards good, abstractly considered. So it's God's will towards good without the consideration of conditions or circumstances. So antecedently, here's the example St. Thomas gives. A judge is going to go to his courtroom every morning antecedently willing to not sentence any man to death. And then upon his day starting, somebody comes in who murdered 50 people, and he is going to justly judge that they be hung. So antecedently, he willed not that any man should die. But consequently, with the consideration of circumstances or the conditions that somebody is in, this is why it's called efficacious and conditional versus the antecedent will, which is inefficacious and unconditional. So the consequent will wills that this man be hung due to the consideration of conditions. So the Thomists would say, when it comes to the passages in sacred scripture that talk about the universal salvific will of God, it is some real, and I'm using this term very loosely, some real relation or some real ordering of God towards good abstractly considered, apart from circumstances, that God truly is said to will that all men be saved. But consequently, so that was the antecedent will. Consequently, upon the consideration of circumstances, he efficaciously wills that only some be saved. He efficaciously wills that only some be saved. And efficaciously wills that others do not receive the efficacious graces to persevere unto the end. And therefore, due to this privation of grace, they fall into sin. And then he gives the decree of damnation on account of that sin. So that's a Thomistic position right there. Now, there's some disagreement amongst the Calvinists, which actually makes this question a little bit more tricky. So the Calvinists, generally speaking, the later ones, the earlier ones, there's some debate on this. But the later ones do not affirm that there is a universal will for God to save. Now, why is this? So it seems like, at least in my view, this is what I have figured out with my own thinking on this topic. It seems like the Calvinists, while on the surface affirming the antecedent versus consequent will distinction, that they don't actually put this into consistent practice in their theology. So they don't believe in what's called sufficient grace, because the Thomists would say that there is a sufficient grace, which is given to all men, that they may be held to be responsible for their rejection of the offer of the gospel. And this sufficient grace flows from the antecedent will of God. And then the efficacious will flows from the consequent will of God. So it seems like while they on the surface will agree with that, the antecedent consequent will distinction, they don't really have anything flowing from the antecedent will of God. It seems like they take Cayetanus and Banez's interpretation that the antecedent will of God is merely the will of expression. It's merely an extrinsic expression externally given to the world. It's not actually like a real sort of push in God towards abstractly considered. So this leads to a denial of sufficient grace, which is pretty horrific. It leads to a denial in later Calvinists and in the majority of Calvinists after that over the universal will of God to save antecedently and really. So it becomes very, very dangerous once they go down that path. So if you're asking about predestination, that's just my general sort of issue right there. And usually the universal will to save stuff is what the counter-reformers get, you know, all upset about. Okay, so there you go. So what necessitates the termination of begetting in the Son? Okay, so the thing that necessitates the termination of begetting in the Son is the fact that the terminus of the production exhausts the infinite fruitfulness of of that procession. So it communicates the entirety of the divinity, the entirety of the numerically singular divinity in the production of a person. So there's nothing else to give because the entire divinity was given through that mode of production. So there can't be like, you know, another begetting that happens after that because all of the begetting already happened, I guess, is the best way of explaining it. Do Muslims have a point when they say that there's absolutely no good effect in drinking alcohol and therefore it is intrinsically evil? No, they have a terrible point with that. Oh, I never posted my favorite De Deo Uno books. Sorry. Okay, I have two. Super chats. The Mass in Hebrews 7:27-28. He had no need to offer sacrifices daily, since he did this once for all when he offered himself up. Okay, so the way in which the Thomists are going to generally receive and respond to this objection is that this is really just talking about the sacrifice of Christ as the one sole and sufficient fount of all graces. Because the mass is merely, again, the sacramental representation of the sacrifice of Christ. So the mass only receives its sacrificial virtue in virtue of the one sacrifice of Christ. So this is why the language about the mass will kind of waffle between whether we speak of it as one sacrifice. So it's the self-same sacrifice, the sacrifice of Christ. And then some other authors will speak of it as, you know, there's a number of sacrifices and the multiple sacrifices of the Mass and stuff like that. So yeah, it's not really a the meaning of the passage when you read it is merely to say that the sacrifice of Christ itself was sufficient, and that there is no independent sacrifice that come after that. But we don't think the Mass is an independent sacrifice. Are you aware that Paul V wrote a bull which condemned Molinism? It just never got published. Yeah, because he died before it got published. For sufficient grace. What about sufficient grace, River? Is it just $10 for sufficient grace? I'm confused. Okay. Okay, again, not answering filioque questions. Nice try, though. Okay, I'm trying to look for questions. Okay, this is... I didn't mean to say that Banez and Cayetan did not affirm sufficient grace. They did affirm sufficient grace. I just think they were... I haven't exactly worked out this point in my brain, in the old noggin, but... So Banez and Cayetan, they basically held that the antecedent will of God was merely the will of expression. So the will of expression, like, you know, the something which is extrinsic, talking about the will of God for mankind. So when God talks about he wills that all be saved, he's talking about that is like the expression of what he would want to happen for the created order. But not it's really weird to explain, but not something which is like an intrinsic sort of you could say ordering towards the good. So yeah, I know that sounds very confusing, but basically since they held that the will of it's the will of expression and not the antecedent will is the will of expression, not something which is distinct from the will of expression, something which is like an intrinsic ordering of God towards good and abstractly considered, it's not entirely clear exactly what sufficient grace is, except consistently it would just be the call to faith, and not actually anything, you know, intrinsic to the person, which is, you know, giving some sort of in first act capability, if you want to put it like that, in order to, you know, elicit an act of faith. So I haven't exactly like worked out, you know, in my brain how Cayetan and Banez consistently held to sufficient grace, since it seems like their view of the antecedent will would actually preclude them from holding to an actually sufficient grace. But, you know, I think the answer might be found in Zumo and Marine Sola. But I need to do more research on that point. That's why I very briefly referred to it and didn't at all go into detail. Do I think... do you think that Molinism is heresy? No. You can't say that Molinism is heresy. Do I think that... So there's a qualifier that we can give to certain theses in theology called proximate definability, which is basically the qualifier that something is contained formally in the deposit of revelation, and therefore if the church wanted to, it could define it as a dogma of the faith. I think the anti-Molinistic theses of the Thomists are of that category. So do I think the church could condemn Molinism as something which is against revelation? Yes, I think the church could. Has the church? No. The church has actually told Thomas to stop calling Molinism heresy and Molinists to stop calling Thomism heresy. So, no, it's not heretical. That's just a fact. It's not heretical. But but the opposite position is proximally definable. So the church could make that judgment one day. What is the most niche book you've ever read? Like focused on such an obscure topic. I read a book on spiritual marriage within like the medieval, within medieval life. Just trying to think through all of like the councils stuff to see like historical accounts of how this stuff looked. Spiritual marriage, for those who don't know, there's a twofold practice in spiritual marriage. So one of them is the fact that people are getting married, and even before they're married, they agree not to consummate the marriage. And this is this was a practice. I'm not sure whether it's a practice today. I haven't heard of a practice today. Well, like Leo the 13th was setting up spiritual marriages in this way. So it's like not, you know, just some old weird medieval or patristic practice. It's something which lasted for a very long time. And the second is taking some sort of private vow after childbearing. Or even like some even did it like, you know, they would have like three or four kids and then take a private vow to chastity and live the rest of their life in as celibates, basically. Some live together still. Some would break off and each go to like live with monks or nuns. That's how it would go. But yeah, it was a very, very interesting topic. And that last sort, the sort of private vow of chastity with Josephite marriage, that continues to this day. People still do it. So yeah. No, I didn't say Molinism was heretical. I didn't say that. You can't say that. Do you think that the prescient view of predestination has any real way to ground God's foreknowledge? What do you mean the prescient view? Are you talking about like the scientia media? Oh, are you talking about post previsa merita, that view? Sorry, I haven't heard that terminology. Is there any good? I wish there was good books on spiritual marriage. No, this stuff, it's so frustrating because it seems like with a lot of this stuff, there was kind of like a common wisdom sort. And there was a common wisdom that was passed down from generation to generation. It seems like priests were talking about it in marriage prep. Parents were talking about it with kids, you know. It was just like some sort of like commonly spoken about thing that people understood. Like there were 200 sexual abstinence days throughout the year. There were spiritual marriages very frequently occurring. It was just a normal thing in society to have the non-licentious view of sexuality. So this was something that was just common and just talked about, and it really didn't need to be said. So we don't have like treatises on this stuff, which were written that we can read about and gain a lot of wisdom from. So it's unfortunate. So no, there's not any, sadly. The historical one that I read was super cringe because it was basically written by some weird feminist. And they were like interpreting spiritual marriage as some like feminist, you know, taking back power like thing. It was cringe. Okay. Okay, did Calvin believe in predestination to evil? Okay, so I've been meaning to do an article about this. but it seems like predestination to evil, what that means, because it pops up in the Council of Arles in the 5th century, I want to say. So that's the first usage of predestination to evil in, that I've seen. And this kind of gets picked up in the Condemnations of Gostock. Gostock, I've never known how to pronounce his name, but that's closest. So it gets picked up in those 8th and 9th century controversies against the first wave of predestinarianism. So it seems like predestination to evil is merely talking about the kind of like a flip side to sanctifying grace. So like desanctifying evil, basically, is there some sort of like substance of evil that God infuses into the soul of the wicked, and that's how they get reprobated. It's not teaching against reprobation by any means. But yeah, that's like the immediate interpretation of the earliest councils when it comes to how they're using the phrase predestination to evil. And it continues even to this day, the usage of the phrase. Okay. I have a lot of questions. Sorry if I'm not able to answer. That's a what are you giving to me? Sign. You need me to sign something? Are you trying to like give me to sign my life away? Oh my goodness. And she's giving me to sign my life away or something. So if I never come back, you know what happened to me. Okay. Well, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. Sorry. There's a lot of questions. So I'm probably not going to be able to get all these. So I'll just pick my favorites. Sorry, guys. So, yeah, that's the whole thing with predestination to evil. Okay. So you explained, you mean God just knows and he predestines based on that. Yeah, that's actually utterly impossible. Because one, it's impossible on the part of God. Because on the part of God, that would make God a passive recipient of knowledge. That would make him determined. And if he's determined and a passive recipient of something extrinsically coming into his knowing faculty, into his intellect, that would completely destroy the doctrine of God. And it's also impossible on the part of the object. So on the part of, you know, the thing, part of the people. Because this would assume that free will itself is something that is not in physical potency. So it's not in natural potency to being sustained by the promotion of God. So if something is a being, then it's being ab alio. Obviously, except God, who's ipsum esse, is being itself. So free will is a being, that is, free will exists, and it has its existence from another. And therefore, it's sustained and brought into being by the motion of God. So both on the part of the object and on the part of God, it's impossible that predestination is just God having a simple foreknowledge. Okay, and that's also the reason I was also answering John Fisher's question, why physical premotion, not a moral motion for predestination. And then when it comes to predestination itself, this gets into like a second level, Because when it comes to predestination is to glory, right? Predestination is to glory. So predestination is not only an ordering of natural causes, of something that's naturally proportioned to an end. It's also the elevation of something to the supernatural order, which natural acts cannot be proportioned to the supernatural order by any means. So this gets into like even a second level of impossibility, which is St. Thomas's point in Prima Secundae, question 109, when he's talking about the essence of grace. Thoughts on planting, I don't know. I don't read them. So how valid are justified marriages and are they consecrated differently? They are valid marriages. It's actually dogmatic that you have to hold to this because the marriage of Joseph and Mary. No, they're not consecrated differently. Okay, so are there Roman Catholic books which describes the Prots well? Oh, man. So I think Suarez's work against the Anglicans is probably the best. But it's really difficult because with most of the works of that era, you basically have Bellarmine. And Bellarmine is responding to what he was able. Well, you have Cajetan. I actually really like Cajetan. And I think he does a really fair job of interpreting. But again, Cajetan only had access to Zwingli, a work from Zwingli, a few works from Melanchthon, and a few works from Luther. That's what he had access to. And then with Bellarmine, he had access to Calvin, Oecolampadius, Luther, Zwingli, I think. But his access was, what I mean to say is his access was all first generation and it was all restricted. So, and then the rest of the polemical tradition kind of picks up on this for the rest of the time. So it's really hard to point to, you know, like fruitful later dialogue on these issues. Maybe Suarez in his work against the Anglicans might be the best. Okay, so here. So to be more specific, did Calvin believe that the penalty of damnation is inflicted before sins are foreseen? No. Not in my reading, no. For my reading, praedamnatio is for all authors something which is inflicted on the account of the sin which flowed from reprobation. I haven't found one who says that praedamnatio and reprobatio are identical degrees. Okay, I guess I'll answer like two more questions. So get all of your questions in. I guess this is a good job, good time for a brief announcement. Not really an announcement. I guess it's more like an advertisement. While you guys throw in all of your questions that you've been wanting to ask, and I pick the best two or three. So if you go to lulu.com/spotlight/militant Thomist, it'll take you to this. Now, what does this have on here? So first it has this, a comprehensive introduction to scholastic philosophy and theology by Charles Copens. This is really meant to be a easy, simple, like undergrad/high school level introduction to scholastic philosophy and theology by Father Charles Copens, SJ, who was a Jesuit in the early 20th century. And it's really good, really, really good. I put it together all in one volume. So it has everything you need, all of the works of Copens that you need all under one volume. So yeah, very, very good. Very, very good. Everything from logic to eschatology is treated in this. So also Father Henri Grenier, his Thomistic philosophy, originally 4 volumes, often sold for like $25-$30 for each volume, impossible to buy. But this is the best like intermediate introduction to Thomistic philosophy in English. And I put it together 1 volume, all typeset, all beautiful, $34.99. Definitely consider getting that. And then what I think is like the good, you know, next step after the catechism sort of book is this. It's called the Theology Library. There were like 70 Dominicans, I think, who came together in France in the 50s to put together like a, you know, an intermediate level theology book meant for laymen, ordered after the ordering of the Summa, which would not only be scholastic, but also be positive. So talk about the sources as well, and to update a lot of the material that's not covered in the Summa. So they created this six-volume work called the Theology Library, which only I'm the only person who's ever printed this. So definitely consider picking that up as well. Okay, so let's see what the questions we got are. Okay, so... Okay, so the first one I'll choose, and this will give you more time. This is gonna be great. So the first one, I remember you saying somewhere that the Cappadocians, Maximus the Confessor, John Damascene, and Palamas were all Thomists. Could you go into more detail on what you meant? Okay, so this will give you a minute because this is always a fun one. So in the Greek Fathers, there is something that's spoken of besides the essence that we know. Okay, this should be we should be obvious right now, because for both the Greek and the Latin fathers, and for St. Thomas himself, the essence of God is utterly unknowable, at least in this life. Utterly unknowable. So there's something besides the essence that we know. Now, the fathers call it different things. So St. Basil will call it the things around God. St. Dionysius will call it the processions, sort of processions of perfections. St. John Damascene will call it the idiomata. St. Maximus will call it the logoi. They're called multiple different things by different fathers. But you have these things out there, which are besides the essence, which are knowable, whereas the essence is unknowable. Now, St. Thomas actually agrees to this, and he interprets the processions of Dionysius in a very interesting way. So what Thomas says is Thomas basically says that we have an imperfection of our intellect, and by imperfection means improportionality to the divinity by nature that we have, which makes the essence of God unknowable to us. But the perfections of God flowing forth in creatures, which are certain limited images, analogous images to his supreme and simple perfection of his essence. Supreme and simple perfection. These things sort of flowing into nature. So from a consideration of all of the perfections of nature, we understand these attributes. And these attributes, when God looks at himself, let's say, when God looks at himself, he doesn't see justice and goodness and mercy and whatever. He sees the supremely simple divine essence. Rather, the dragging down of all of these multiple different attributes are due to the supreme perfection of the divinity coming into contact with the limitedness of our intellects. So we know that which is simple under multiple different aspects, if you want to put it like that. So St. Thomas, he has this very interesting language. He'll use "in" sometimes, but actually the language he usually uses is he'll say that the attributes correspond to the divine essence. They correspond to the divine essence. So these perfections which flow forth into creation correspond to the divine essence. Because the divine essence is up here. All the perfections flow forth. It's kind of like we can think of you have the white light up here comes through a crystal and then beams out into all of the colors of the rainbow. So we know the colors of the rainbow down here, and there's a correspondence between the colors of the rainbow and the white light, but the colors of the rainbow are not in the white light. So what St. Thomas will say is St. Thomas will say that perfections of a higher order are going to simply resolve all the perfections of the lower order. So all of the perfections that we know truly correspond to the divinity, but they aren't in the divinity as, you know, attributes. So the divinity, rather, will resolve in a super simple manner, all of the perfections of this lower order. And it's something which is inaccessible to our intellects, because the essence of God is unknowable until we see it in the divine, in the beatific vision, when the light of glory is infused into our intellects, and by a participation in the very knowledge of God, we become proportioned in a certain or in the same order as the knowledge of God. So we have the vision of God. So for me, basically, it seems like Thomas's concern and the concern of all the Greek fathers that I talked about in the beginning, the same. It's the same concern. The concern is, how do we truly know God while the essence is something which is inaccessible? And it seems like they're all saying that there are certain perfections which precede the creation. That seems like what they say. And that the essence itself is the resolves all of these perfections in a super simple way. So, yeah, I'm making the essence energy distinction. Yeah. Okay, so I will now look through all of the questions to see which one I want to answer as my last question. But I hope that explained it well. I'm still lisping for stuttering, I guess would be a better way of translating this into like a more modern idiom. But I'm still stuttering to find the words to express this. But it seems very clear in Thomas to me. Okay. Let me see. Yes, I'm making the essence energy distinction, Christian Wagner, 2023. So true. Okay. So why wouldn't all good, all loving God destroy or annihilate those in hell and remove dysfunction, anger, frustration, pain, evil forever? Okay, so St. Thomas, he kind of answers this question. So St. Thomas says that God has a universal love for all creatures. It's correct. And his universal love is this sort of fount of goodness. So every single creature, to the least rock, to the most the highest of the angels, any sort of goodness that they have in them is flows forth from the love of God. So what St. Thomas says is, because of this diversity, if you want a really good reflection on this, so all of you stop right now what you're doing, listen to me, pay attention if you're kind of just not paying attention. If you have questions about this whole goodness, love, predestination stuff, read the introduction to the autobiography of St. Thérèse of Lisieux's Autobiography of the Soul. Very, very good. And she explains all of this in remarkable simplicity and profundity in the initial letter to her sister, who's also her prioress. So after that brief aside, basically everything God loves and any goodness that it has flows forth from God. But God's universal love does not necessitate that every single creature receive every good. So just because God loves a rock does not mean that that rock needs to be raised to the level of a cherubim. The cherubim. It doesn't mean that. A cherub, I guess, would be the singular. It doesn't mean that at all. Or a seraph. Rather, what it does mean is, in order for God to love, is it has some sort of goodness. That is, that it receives some sort of being. It receives some sort of act of existence. So those in hell still express the supreme love of God in the fact that he sustains them in existence, and the fact that he tempers his punishments in hell with his mercy. So that's really the answer, is that the fact that God is all loving does not at all necessitate that he doesn't punish, because he still expresses that love in the sustenance of their existence and the tempering of his justice and mercy. So, yeah, basically TLDR, he would not destroy anything good, and even the damned of being, which is good. Okay, so that is all. Sorry, I do have to go. If you haven't already, become a patron, because, you know, that'd be pretty cool. That'd be pretty cool. So thank you. And as always, God bless.